Hello, listeners. Our planned topic for this week is around the idea or identity of Canadian cuisine. Clearly, in Canada, we're having an identity crisis as Indigenous people fight for the recognition of atrocities which have been perpetrated on them by our governmental and religious institutions. Institutions which continue to drag their feet when it comes to acknowledging and making some effort to repair the harm that they've done. Neither Alan or I consider ourselves to be experts in the subject matter surrounding these issues, but we thought it appropriate, given that the topic of this episode touches on the issues of colonialism, to acknowledge that we are two non-Indigenous men talking about a subculture of food in a nation which is built on land unjustly claimed by our ancestors, actions for which the harm is still ongoing. This show has made a donation to the Indian Residential School Survivors Society, and we urge our listeners to donate or to continue to raise awareness and encourage discussion of these issues. This podcast is recorded on the traditional territories of the Indigenous peoples of Treaty 6 territory and the Métis settlements and Métis Nation of Alberta. We respect the histories, languages, and cultures of the First Nations, Métis, Inuit, and all First Peoples in our nation. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever seen asparagus in the River Valley?
No, but I've looked several times, and yeah. And you have like told me a couple places where I could go to look, and
I did.
Looked in. Yeah,
I divulged.
You told me one place.
Oh, really?
Should I talk about it?
No.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sedeby. Hi, Alan.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Great. We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
We've got follow-up.
Oh, follow-up. We didn't forget about it this time.
Yeah.
It's a miracle. Okay, what do we have to follow up about, Alan? Do you know?
I don't know how serious we were about this, but we had mentioned, I think, you rewriting the yummy chicken recipe.
Rewriting the recipe? We said that?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think that's what we said, but like it was kind of a joke, and I don't even know if it's interesting to rewrite it. Maybe that's
I'm
not
just
interesting.
I don't know if it's interesting, but I rewrote it.
But you did you already did it. You did the work, so now we're all gonna listen to it, whether it's interesting or not.
Exactly.
Oh boy.
Well, no, actually, we're all going to listen to it, and then you're going to have to determine, you're going to have to be the judge of whether it was interesting
okay.
or not. So, yeah, you tell me, Alan. Here's the original. Yummy chicken. And then there's a subtitle. It says, "The name says it all!" Mm-hmm. Exclamation mark. Quarter cup flour. 2 teaspoons of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of pepper, dash of thyme, 3 to 4 pounds cut up chicken, 1/4 cup of butter, melted, 4 green onions, chopped, 1/2 cup of mushrooms, sliced. Doesn't seem like a lot of mushrooms now that I'm thinking about it. 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, 1 teaspoon of sugar, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/3 cup of apple juice. And here's the method. Mix flour, salt, pepper, and thyme in a plastic bag. Shake chicken to coat well.
I'm sorry. What?
I mean, I know this is stupid, but like, it doesn't even tell you to put the chicken in the bag. Like, I mean, I know it seems self-evident,
right?
But like, what if it's not? Then
read the sentence again.
I'll start from the beginning.
Oh god.
Mix flour, salt, pepper, and thyme in a plastic bag. Shake chicken to coat well.
Like this is just turning, you're like the Amelia Bedelia of recipes. Like you're gonna start shaking the chicken, like you're gonna pick up the chicken in your hands and shake it around because that's what the recipe said.
I mean, I might. Brown chicken and butter in removed casserole dish. Add green onions and mushrooms to frying pan. Cover and simmer for 3 minutes. I guess you're simmering it in the liquid that's going to come out of the mushrooms. Add to casserole dish. Mix lemon juice, sugar, salt, and apple juice. pour over chicken and bake at 325 Fahrenheit, 160 Celsius for 1 hour. Serve six. There's no way that serves six people. It's a half a cup of mushrooms before they're even cooked in there.
It's like half a pound of chicken per person.
Yeah, I guess. When it was raw.
Mm-hmm. Well, unless you were doing 4 pounds. Anyway, sorry. Let's hear your recipe.
Okay.
I'm going to tear this apart.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to tear into me, Alan. Okay. Just like a little caveat, with like a couple of small exceptions, I tried to keep all of the ingredients in the recipe pretty much exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I tried not to change the recipe into something different.
Right.
I tried to keep it, you know.
Yummy.
Yummy. Exactly. Okay. Here's my recipe. Yummy chicken. And there's a subtitle that says, feel free to rename this dish and claim the recipe as your own.
You took out the best part of the recipe.
I don't know. I felt like that was more in keeping with my philosophy. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then there's two sections to the ingredients. There's the dredge and then there's the rest. So the dredge, 1/4 cup all-purpose flour, 1/4 cup of rice flour, 2 teaspoons of kosher salt, 1 teaspoon of fresh ground pepper, 1 teaspoon of dried thyme. And then that's the dredge. And then in the rest, there's 3 to 4 pounds boneless, skinless chicken thigh cut into 1-inch by 1-inch pieces, 1/4 cup of salted butter, 4 green onions sliced, 1/2 cup of button mushrooms sliced, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, zest from 1 lemon. That was one of my additions. Oh, and the rice flour. I mean, if you're going to juice that lemon, you might as well use the zest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1 teaspoon of granulated sugar, 1 teaspoon of kosher salt, 1/3 cup of apple juice. Okay, here comes the boring part, Alan. Preheat your oven to 325 degrees Fahrenheit. Add the dredge to a large zip-top bag and shake to combine thoroughly. Add the chicken pieces to the bag until all of the chicken is thoroughly coated. Remove the chicken pieces from the bag and reserve on a plate. Add 2/3 of the butter to a large heavy bottom frying pan and heat on medium-high heat until the butter is melted and starts to brown at the edges. Carefully add the chicken pieces to the pan in a single layer, taking care not to crowd them in the pan. Leave 1/4 inch between pieces, that's in parentheses. It may take more than one round to brown them all. Cook and turn the chicken pieces until they're browned on all sides. As the chicken is browned, remove it to a 9 by 13 inch casserole.
Or as I would say, a casserole. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Or a Dutch oven or a piece of tin foil or whatever you got. Once all the chicken is browned, add the remaining butter to the pan, add the mushrooms and 1/2 of the green onions. Season with 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt and 3 or 4 grinds of fresh ground black pepper. Once the mushrooms are sizzling, cover the pan with a lid or foil and allow to simmer for 3 minutes. Add the mushroom mixture to the casserole with the chicken. In a small bowl, mix together the lemon juice, lemon zest, apple juice, kosher salt, and sugar. Pour this mixture over the chicken and mushrooms and bake in the middle of the oven for 35 minutes or until the chicken reaches an internal temperature of 70 degrees Celsius. Turn the oven to broil, transfer the casserole to the top rack. Cook on broil for 2 to 3 minutes, keeping an eye on the chicken until it's crispy and golden brown on top. Remove from the oven and garnish with the remaining green onions, then order takeout.
How many people does it serve? Just kidding.
Who friggin' knows? I would guess that it serves more like 4 people, but you obviously have to make some vegetables to go with it. Mm-hmm. Because,
yeah. Okay, so yeah, a lot of details added in the description of the ingredients. Certainly loads added in the procedure. Some just plain old courteous additions, like step number one, preheat your oven.
Right. That's
very gentlemanly of you. That's very...
Oh, thank you. Actually, I got to the end of the recipe and then I was like, oh, did I say to preheat the oven? And then I went back and put it back in because I almost forgot. If you've ever seen a Best of Bridge cookbook, you know the font they use in there and you know how important that font is. And certainly you wouldn't be able to fit my recipe on one page and use that same font. Right. So, maybe best of bridge is like, maybe it's like a tiered list of priorities, starting with the font and then working its way down to
more
the validity of the recipe.
Yeah,
which is somewhere down near the bottom of the list. I don't know.
I think I mentioned last time, like I have not seen a best of bridge cookbook. What is the font? Something cute or?
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's sort, yeah, like a hand printed kind of italic sort of font. It's it's not as bad as like Comic Sans or something like that, but
each page is supposed to be like a recipe card kind of.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And actually, if I'm remembering correctly, they like come in a, they're coil bound and like, they're coil bound with one of those big plastic coils.
Right.
And so you can easily open up the coil and remove them, I think.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's the same with the Company's Coming series. It's a handy kitchen book binding technique.
Yeah, definitely. Like binding your recipe book, if you want it to be used in a kitchen on like a coil binding, is smart.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, if you can afford to do it, smart to print it on waterproof paper.
Yeah.
But very few cookbooks do that. In fact, I can only think of one. The kitchen manual from the
Modernist Cuisine.
They
thought
set
of everything.
Is printed on waterproof paper and bound with a coil. So you can flip it open to what you want and pour lemon juice all over it.
That was another, we were talking about like when you were annoyed that they don't specify whether it's fresh or dried thyme,
right?
And I told you that for most of the people who are using this book, like at least I said I don't think my mom ever had fresh thyme in our kitchen. There are things she wouldn't have had, like when I was growing up, there wouldn't have been fresh lemons in our kitchen either. We would have been using real lemon brand lemon juice. So
I seriously thought about specifying that in the recipe when I was making it, but I figured adding the zest would like nudge people in the direction of understanding.
But we would have measured out our real lemon juice.
Yeah.
And then we would have zested a lemon like your recipe called for. And then we would just throw the lemon in the garbage because we wouldn't know what to do with it. Just kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, and I left the dried thyme in because for a breading, totally makes sense.
Totally.
Yeah. Was there anything else that we needed to follow up?
Well,
about?
we don't have to follow up on anything. But we had mentioned I kind of like jokingly read that Escoffier recipe for beef tongue a la Bigarade, and I won't. I promise not to read from Le Guide Culinaire, but like you kind of tasked me or challenged me to go back into the book and see what kind of, like if they do actually clearly explain what,
like the braising method.
Cause it said braise in the usual manner. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The way the book is structured, each section begins with technique and theory. And so if you go back, like that beef tongue a la Bigarade is in a little section of beef tongue recipes. And at the start of that, it explains that you boil the tongue for 30 minutes and that so that you can peel the skin off and then proceed to braise in the usual manner. And then if you go to the very beginning of the section on entrees, it has a very detailed, a qualitatively detailed standard braising procedure.
Okay.
It even had some quantities that surprised me. Like for instance, it had a weight of like mirepoix that you would use per kilo of meat for your braising. But there was loads of detail in the procedure, how to season and marinate the meat, how to sear it, adding mirepoix, liquid quantities for the braise, how to make a sauce, how to glaze the meat afterwards, how to tell it's done cooking. The one funny thing though is we kind of harped on this in the cooking myths episode. Escoffier does a lot in these descriptions to try and explain why you're doing it, but I think that a lot of his whys are are completely inaccurate.
Right. And are like the source, like are the, yeah, the source material for cooking myths that now exist.
Yeah. So he does mention explicitly, like, you sear it to seal in the juices. And but there's other strange things about how, what is happening when the meat is tenderizing. I can't remember all the details, but he said something like that. It's the expanding, like once the meat, the internal temperature of the meat gets hot enough, like expanding vapor is like forcing muscle fibers apart or something. Like, it, I think it's just not rigorously scientifically true. but anyways, there is quite a bit. There's a lot of detail in it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, they used to bleed people to cure diseases, Alan. So
yes.
Probably around the same time frame.
Honestly, I have no idea. Maybe the other, just quickly, the other interesting thing was that the recipe for sauce bigarade, which is like our duck a l'orange sauce, it had some pretty funny, like, you take the braising liquor from a duck and you reduce it until it's pretty thick, kind of like,
right.
So you would need to have a background. You would have to be a professional cook working at that time in those kitchens to understand what they're looking for.
Right.
But the interesting thing was that the, like, sauce bigarade, as it's taught in culinary school now, is it starts with a gastrique, like a caramelized sugar and vinegar. And that is not in Escoffier's recipe. It's basically just reduced duck braising liquid, orange juice and lemon juice, and demi-glace or sauce espagnole or something. But anyways, no vinegar and no sugar.
Was there any indication of what liquid to use as a base for the braise? Were you correct in thinking that it was probably veal stock, or is that mentioned at all? Or does he give some kind of way to figure out what to use to braise it in?
The braising procedures are broken down by protein type. So there's like a one for red meats, which is what I was using for this tongue procedure.
Makes sense.
I think. And so, like, for the red meats, they're always marinated in red wine, and they're always braised in, quote, good brown stock.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it could be, yeah. So it's, yeah. So it's stock made from roasted bones of, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So cool. probably veal.
Veal
in that
and
context,
or beef,
I think.
And
but,
or, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And, but they still want, but he still wants you to reduce the duck braise to make the sauce for this.
Well, that's an interesting question. Like, so it just says in our beef tongue recipe, it just says serve it with sauce bigarade. Mm-hmm. And the description for sauce bigarade, like, it's based on duck braising liquid. So
right.
I assume it's like they were braising ducks. They made this sauce. They've got it kicking around and it happens to go good with beef tongue.
Fair enough.
I don't think that they would make a dedicated sauce bigarade that's like based off of beef, like the beef tongue. Oh, maybe the braising liquid from the beef tongue becomes, it doesn't
the
say that
sauce
though.
For the
it doesn't say that.
Well, but it does say demi-glace, and if you were going to reduce the stock, or if you were going to reduce the liquid from the braise, you know, you would, like, didn't you say that demi-glace is one of the possible components of the sauce bigarade?
Yeah, like the way I think it's technically a derivative sauce of Espagnol, but like in culinary school nowadays, like, typically you're working with demi-glace instead of Espagnol.
Oh, instead of Espagnol.
Okay. I can't recall which one is called for in this book, but
yeah. Well, cause I was going to say, if you have two different reductions, like two different stock reductions in there, then you know, if it's calling for duck one and it's calling for the braise from the, or a different demi-glace or espagnole, then you would probably make that from the braising liquid. And
right.
You
know, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the more you know, Alan.
Yeah.
So what are we talking about this week?
I'm kind of nervous about this one.
Are you?
Yeah. I feel like
I'll be honest. I'm a little bit nervous too.
Oh, okay. Is there something you need to talk about, or?
I just mean that, well, maybe we can get into it a little bit, but I don't know if I want to preface the topic or whether we should talk about it after we introduce the topic, but.
Oh. Are you talking about Kamloops?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the topic, I don't know exactly how we wanted it worded, but we wanted to mm-hmm. talk about the idea of Canadian cuisine. And I think one element of it was that I've always found the question, is there a Canadian cuisine, kind of annoying for a number of reasons. But the reason, yeah, so the reason that I'm a little bit nervous about having this conversation is because I feel like I will be making like general statements about history and demographics and tradition that like I'm not like I'm not a university researcher with like a background in Canadian history and migration and stuff like that. Like I'm just
right.
It's just a conversation. Like I'm a cook, and it's just like a conversation that we would have in the kitchen, and it being a recording and a conversation. If it were a blog post, I could just go back and edit things as I see fit, but
totally. But all you've got with you is your wits, and that's what you have to rely on.
Well, that's what I just wanted to qualify it, because it's like there are books written on the topic by people who actually study this, but this is just like the perspective of someone who works in the food industry and loves food and cooking, but not an expert and not an academic. So I don't know. That's why I was a bit nervous, but I wanted to say that off the top.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, the reason why I'm a little bit nervous is because I think that, you know, any discussion of Canadian cuisine, has to inevitably involve some discussion about colonialism. Mm-hmm. And obviously, that's pretty tough subject matter right now, because of, the uncovering of a mass grave of children in Kamloops. Mm. I just wanted to make a touch point there and just, say that like the conversation isn't necessarily about colonialism, but that, there are definitely some sensitive issues around it. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to make sure that there's maybe a little bit of a trigger warning up front. I guess I just want to try and be sensitive to it. That's mm-hmm. all. Mm-hmm.
I was picturing this, the topic phrased as, is there a Canadian cuisine? Maybe it still happens, but like 10 years ago, it was kind of like a almost, this is not exactly the right word, but kind of like a clickbait question that like bloggers and on social media and stuff would get posted, just because it was sure to attract loads of comments on both sides. Like foodies who are adamant that of course there's a cuisine and it's this and this and this, and then other people just like being snobs and saying of course there's no Canadian cuisine, but like not even talking about whether or not the cuisine exists. They're just saying like our food culture is nothing compared to France and Italy, and it was just so it always irritated me. It seemed like no one was ever talking about the same thing, and no one was ever actually really talking about cuisine. They were talking about things like ingredients and mm-hmm. shale. Is there a Canadian cuisine?
I don't even know what side of this argument I'm on, honestly.
It might not even be an argument, really.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe argument's not the right word.
It's just a dumb question. It's a dumb question.
You're right, Alan. It's a dumb question and it's reductive.
Yes, exactly. It's like it's turns it into a yes or no answer. And it's like such a ridiculously complicated question to unpack. Mm-hmm. Like, because Canada is huge, and like you're talking about different groups of people, waves of migration over centuries, over like thousands and thousands of miles. Like, yes, it's reductive.
I think it's a ridiculous assertion that there could not be a Canadian cuisine, mm-hmm. because we're in Canada and we're eating.
Right.
So I don't know. I can understand the soapbox that maybe some people stand on in terms of, you know, like trying to pick that apart, where, you know, it's pretty easy to see when you look at what type of food is available in Canada that, you know, like a large proportion of it is imported from other cultures. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, I mean, a part of what actually makes it a thing. Mm-hmm. What makes it stand on its own is, in large part, is its diversity. Mm-hmm. And if you have to point to something where, you know, if you have to point at something and say, you know, like, what is it? What is Canadian cuisine? And, or is there a way to define it? I think that that's kind of where you have to start. Mm-hmm. Is like at, or like the starting point is that it's cobbled together from the entire history of the country. So starting with Indigenous food and Indigenous ingredients, and then adding in English, French, Scottish, all of those sort of early settlers, the cuisines that they brought with them as well. And then you just start, you know, you just keep adding to that as more and more people started to immigrate to Canada from other places around the world. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah.
So, okay. I think you made an important point. So what's the definition of cuisine? Cuisine is just how people feed themselves. So if there's people eating, then they're, must be a cuisine?
I think so.
Okay. I think that's one of the, like when I mentioned that different, when people would answer this question online, it's like they're answering two different questions. And I think you're right. On the one hand, obviously there's a cuisine because we are feeding ourselves. But if you think of cuisine more, okay, so if cuisine is defined as like a cooking style that with, you know, defined common ingredients, techniques, and dishes or recipes that are shared within a community. Like, I think some people will start arguing that, well, there's obviously no homogenous Canadian cuisine of that sort. The way that you, like, I know that, say, Italian food, like, obviously there's huge regional variations, but like, there's patterns there, like with pasta and gnocchi and wine and, like, you know, that kind of thing. There's patterns there that you probably don't, you, like, with the exception of some really important regional Canadian cuisines, like Quebecois or Acadian or something like that, it's hard to see those overarching shared traditions, partly, like, and that's for a number of reasons. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, to me, it also, I don't know, like, part of the discussion, I think, is that even in regions in the world where it seems very obvious that, you know, a country or a region has a specific cuisine, mm-hmm. it's always a way more complicated story.
Yes.
than you can really tease out without having an idea of the history of the place and where the foods come from. And, well, I don't know, I guess like a hilarious and stupid example is like how, you know, pasta is not actually Italian or whatever. And I'm sure it's like apocryphal and I'm sure it's like a bunch of BS, but, you know, there's a story about how Marco Polo went to China and brought back noodles.
But isn't that just from a Canadian pasta marketing campaign from the 60s or something?
Oh, I mean, yeah, could be, I suppose. I don't remember anything before 1974. Oh, so
I'm pretty sure that there was a Canadian brand of pasta that used that idea in a commercial.
I'm sure you're right, but I don't think that's where it originated.
Oh, okay.
I think that it's like, I don't know. It probably is like a dumb Americanized, like, you know, story about food or something. I don't know. I don't think it has its origins in a commercial, although I could be wrong.
Okay. Add it to the list of things to look
at. Totally. But like, I guess like the point that I'm trying to make by saying that is that like cuisines get imported from all over the world to the places where they then become what are sort of like the defining characteristics of a specific country or a specific region's cuisine. And, you know, the origins of those things are most likely in most cases, not just the people in the region, like probably in most cases, you know, people moved to those regions and then brought cuisine with them, you know, or brought food ideas with them. And so,
I think you're right. Like, from the outside, say like North Americans think that everything in Europe is neat and tidy and codified and has been done that way for centuries and centuries. Mm-hmm. But it's nowhere near as tidy once you're there. Like obviously there's like, even within Europe, there's like loads, like lots of tumultuous history and migration. And yeah, the you know, countries don't really, or culture doesn't start and stop at national borders. And so like, you know, the last hour on your way north out of Italy, like you're seeing loads of German family names and town names and everything. Right. It's all kind of blurred there.
Yeah. Or like in Alsace, it's crazy. Like, you know, exactly. Alsace is like German and French, like both wine and food, like, you know, cross pollination. Yeah. And it's, yeah, like the wine there is amazing. Yes. And especially if you like German wine, like it's wine's unbelievable. And the food is like, yeah, very, very much a mixture of like German food and French food.
But that being said, like the food traditions in a place like Italy, like they are nowhere near, like, what am I trying to say here? Even with all the stuff we just said, like if you go to a certain region of Italy at a certain time of year, oftentimes all the restaurants are serving the same dish because that's like, that's the culture and that's the tradition. So like if I was in around Alba in October, and so September, and everywhere we went, they were serving like braised rabbit with eggplant and hazelnut gelato and like all these important regional seasonal preparations.
Sounds delicious.
You don't, it was. That's the image that a lot of, especially food elites have of a cuisine. That kind of tradition of shared ingredients, techniques, and dishes. And there's not like, if you're considering Canada as a whole, which is a dumb thing to do, but if you're considering Canada as a whole, you definitely don't see something like that. That doesn't mean there's not that there's not cuisine here, but I think that's why a lot of food snobs get angry about the issues, because our food culture is so much different than something like the small town of Alba in northern Italy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I agree. There, that type of, well, I don't know. Like, I think that there are probably pockets of that type of regionality and like, you know, specific harvest traditions in, you know, some in a lot of like small Canadian communities or things like that, that, you know, probably I just don't really know about or have been exposed to. Mm-hmm. I think that there's probably a lot more of those types of things in Quebec, maybe, than there are in the Prairie provinces, and maybe in the Maritimes as well. Like more like specific, like, you know, it's a specific time of year. Like I think in the Maritimes, like, you know, there is probably in the Maritimes are probably specific times of year when, you know, specific fish are available or are like readily available. And so there's probably traditions around that kind of thing. And
the people who have, I'm thinking about the cookbooks I have. It's just interesting to me that so many people were really eager or possibly even desperate to have everything to create or present a Canadian cuisine. Mm-hmm. And I have a, like, I just realized today, actually, there was two that I have that I was thinking of, and I just realized today that they're actually written by the same person.
Oh, no.
They're both written by Anita Stewart.
Okay.
So I have one called Anita Stewart's Canada, and one, it's called, I think it's called Great Canadian Cuisine, and it's actually, it was written by her, but it's published by the Canadian Fairmont Hotels.
Okay.
So I have those books, and they're fine. To be honest, they're not that interesting to me.
What, like, what's, can you explain a little bit about like what's in them? Are they basically recipe books, or are they more like food history books, or like?
They're recipe books, but especially Anita Stewart's Canada has lots of, like, lots of, you know, extra information and stories about individuals and bits of history and stuff in the margins. Anita Stewart's Canada is, it's exactly like, it's very much in the, like Canada, I don't know if they still say this. When I was growing up, Canada, we like, it was a cultural mosaic, right? People like, we're largely a country of immigrants and there's culture imported into our country, that people can continue to practice here. And so that's kind of how the book is structured regionally. But there's all like, there's Greek and Middle Eastern and Italian and French and indigenous and like all these kinds of, recipes in the book. So it's a fine book, and there's good recipes, great pictures, great stories, a little bit of history, but to me, there's not the cohesive voice or the cohesion to say that this is Canadian cuisine. Right. Whereas now compare that to something like books that focus on regions and regional traditions. So like you talk about the Maritimes, like the Jeremy Charles book Wildness about cooking in Newfoundland is like just, it's ostensibly a recipe book, but it's just like so full of culture and cultural color. It just like is much more interesting and has much more of an impact on me than the broad, like kind of the grab bag Canadian ones, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
There's loads of examples, like for Quebecois cuisine, like the Pied de Cochon cookbook, the Joe Beef cookbooks, the Toque cookbook, where they like, when they focus on the region that actually does have a shared cultural tradition, those hit me a lot harder.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, and that's that, like, there are plenty of Canadian cuisines. Just trying to nail one down and call it, or trying to throw a bunch of things in a basket and say, these are the things that together make Canadian cuisine, is just never gonna work. You know, it's a bigger country than that, and it's more regional than that. And so it just doesn't really, maybe that's legitimately the problem that people run into when they start to try to think about it, or when they approach the question, is that, you know, like it's hard to lump it all into one basket or whatever. Did I break that metaphor? You put a lump in a basket.
I don't know. Lump it into a basket.
Just lump it into a basket. Everybody says that.
So the other cookbook I mentioned, Great Canadian Cuisine, The Contemporary Flavors of Canadian Pacific Hotels. So these are now the Fairmont Hotels, but it used to be Canadian Pacific. Mm-hmm. To me, this is also, it's organized regionally, but some great examples of Western alienation in our country here.
Oh, God.
The regional sections are Atlantic Canada, Quebec, Central Canada, Prairies to the Rockies, and British Columbia. So there's Alberta, Saskatchewan. Oh, actually, I don't know if Manitoba is in Central.
Yeah, I don't know.
Or Prairies to the Rockies.
I don't know either. And it doesn't say anything about the Northern Territories, which I think is kind of a strange and crazy omission, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot. That's like, yeah, the bias of history. Like, do you know the Time Life World Food Cookbook series?
I mean, I'm aware of it, but my knowledge of it is very, what's the word? Like, dimmed through the lens of time.
Right. It's an extensive set of cookbooks representing all the regions of the world, but it's just funny that there's one, at least one book for every country in Europe. Well, I mean, they lump Scandinavia together and stuff like that. But then, and they'll be like, you know, four or five or six books just on the different American, like United States regional cuisines. Mm-hmm. And then there's one book for Africa.
Oh my God.
For the entire continent of Africa.
It's probably all Dutch food.
It's so, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all Afrikaans and
yeah.
Anyways, this book, Great Canadian Cuisine, is of the, organized by region, and it features chefs and dishes from the Canadian Pacific hotels. But to me, this is like an example of people really wanting something to sound Canadian,
right?
But does not represent a cuisine. It's like they just take these certain ingredients that just have this Canadian cachet. Mm-hmm. And then that makes it Canadian cuisine, but that's not what cuisine is.
Totally. You're working up to, like, I think sort of like the main or the fulcrum of the point that I've sort of had in the back of my head while we've been talking about this,
which is what,
which is that, like, through the discussion that you're talking about like, is, you know, what is a Canadian cuisine and does it exist and et cetera, there are a bunch of like ingredients or techniques or other, you know, pieces of food culture that have sort of been like hung on the
mantle.
Sure. That have been hung. Yeah, that works. That have been hung on the mantle of Canadian cuisine in a very stereotypical way. Or creating, yes. Stereotypes around what people consider to be Canadian cuisine, which is the mm-hmm. which is, like, you know, the real, I think, the problem with the issue is mm-hmm. that everyone who wants to make a statement about, you know, what Canadian cuisine is tries to do so by, like, you know, latching on to a certain ingredient or a certain technique or something and claiming that that's sort of like the soul of Canadian cuisine or something, and then it trends for a little while and becomes a part of this sort of lexicon that people think of when they try to define what Canadian cuisine is. And mm-hmm. I don't know, like, I have a few examples in my head, but I'm curious, Alan, do you what jumps out to you as being like a stereotypical Canadian ingredient that people bring up when they're trying to sort of like define what Canadian cuisine is?
Cobble together the idea of a homogenous Canadian cuisine. Well, like the front runner has to be maple syrup, right?
Yeah, for sure. And like,
which
it's sort of legit. I mean, it's certainly prevalent here, and it's, you know, Canada is one of the biggest exporters of maple syrup. I'm sure that the indigenous history of using maple syrup is not just Canadian. I'm sure it's mm-hmm. Canadian mm-hmm. and American, like before those borders really existed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a pretty prevalent ingredient. I would say that there's some legitimacy to that one.
It's kind of, okay. Well, tell me what you think of this then. It is actually a highly regional, in terms of its production, mm-hmm. it's highly regional.
Yeah.
It's really only made mostly in Quebec, but also in Ontario, New Brunswick, and probably Nova Scotia. I don't actually know if it's, I don't know. But like, we should fact check this, but like, I think that Quebec alone produces something like 75% of the world's maple syrup. And I'm not exaggerating, like it's something in that ballpark. It is not produced commercially west of Ontario, to my knowledge.
Well, yeah.
We still enjoy it, but like there's no sugar shacks in Alberta, right?
No,
like,
because there's no maple trees in Alberta.
There's no sugar maples, right? So it's just interesting. Yeah. Like, and I get it. It's become a Canadian emblem. It's on the flag, for goodness sake. But like it's not like it wouldn't be an integral part to a prairie cuisine because we don't make it here. Do you
absolutely
know what I mean?
But we do love it here, just like the Americans. I eat it on my pancakes, or used to.
Yeah. Okay, so maple syrup.
Okay, yeah, maple syrup's a big one.
It's an obvious one. The one for like the style of cuisine that's being described, sorry, and cuisine in quotation marks in this Canadian Pacific Hotels book, it was wild rice. To me, like, that's like a kind of like, that's a gourmet, yep. something you see in a fancy restaurant that just immediately makes the plate Canadian. Mm-hmm.
That's a big one. I also think that game meats, pretty much any kind of game meats, that's like a big Canadian cuisine stereotype. Wild rice and game meat, you're eating in Canada.
Yeah.
That's not going to be on a menu anywhere else.
In the LaRousse Gastronomique entry for Canada, one of the first things it mentions is like, Canada's covered in forests and replete with like delicious wild game. However, the state forbids its sale and consumption in restaurants.
Yeah. Classic.
Like, which is just, it's just funny that that's like one of the kind of like the first words out of the mouth of Europe sort of is like, oh man, Canada could be serving so much delicious, true wild game, but they don't. There are reasons for that, obviously, like it's for conservation, but,
Yeah, I wonder though, like, yeah. Aren't there a lot of caribou? I don't know. You tell me, Alan. I don't know.
Well, actually, so that's like, again, this needs to be fact checked. But so it is illegal to, like, if you serve true wild game in a restaurant, like that's trafficking in wild game, mm-hmm. and that's a federal crime. But in Newfoundland, they have so much moose there that they can, I believe, hunt it and serve it in restaurants, which is why it is actually like a big part of that that Jeremy Charles book I mentioned called Wildness. So yeah, I'm pretty sure that there's some kind of exemption in Newfoundland for moose.
Yeah.
Caribou, I think, are threatened, but I don't actually know.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know either.
Because of climate change and stuff. Yeah.
I just know that when I was working in Europe, yeah, we were able to get wild birds. Like, yeah. Like wild ducks and other things, you know?
Yeah. Like when I was working in Austria, like they would serve, it was May and they had May deer on all the menus, Maibock, like young deer. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if, I actually don't know, but maybe the forests are stocked. Like, do you know what I mean? Like they might stock the forest with game. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Interesting. Can you think of any other weird stereotypical
for ingredients? Salmon.
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty big one. I'd say like some, I don't know, tell me if I'm crazy, but I think that like blueberries with meat or Saskatoon berries with meat, those two things are like a thing.
Yeah, that's actually in I think I've mentioned before, like we had an Austrian exchange student staying with us one summer, mm-hmm. and we took him to, there was some kind of event. Oh, is Indulgence. Do you know that event, Indulgence?
Yeah, I do. It's so like, it's a bunch of restaurants in Edmonton. They get together, they set up booths in like one cent, like in a, you know, convention center or something. And then they sell tickets, mm-hmm. and people come and get like a bite from each restaurant.
Yeah. And the restaurants are paired with producers, right. like with farmers or yeah. But anyways, we took our Austrian student to that event. And at the end he said, why do Canadians put blueberries in everything?
Oh man, I knew it.
Because there was like a blueberry sausage and blueberry gastrique, blueberry gastrique on everything. And
it's true. Oh my God.
So yeah, I don't know.
Well, how embarrassing.
And yeah, I think in the prairies, Saskatoon's kind of, even though they're not the same thing, they definitely are stand-ins. They're used as stand-ins because they look the same as blueberries, but.
I mean, there's like plenty of stereotypical Canadian foods. Well, or like, at least there's a few of them, but I don't know if they're like a part of the Canadian cuisine conversation.
Are you talking about poutine?
I mean, that's going to be number one on the list, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poutine, Nanaimo bars, oh, Caesars. Yeah.
Got them all. Tortiere. Or is that too regional?
I mean, yeah, that's a legitimately like regional Canadian, French Canadian dish. So, but you know, the idea of tortiere being like a Canadian dish is like, yeah, kind of, I don't know. Tortiere is like definitely a legitimate regional French Canadian dish. But then, yeah, it also gets used as like, a stereotypical sort of like Canadian cuisine stand-in.
Did you have anything else for ingredients?
Bacon. Well, back bacon.
Oh man.
That one's huge. Can't believe that one was fifth or whatever.
In Canada, we just call it bacon, but
no.
That's not it at all.
It's like how in China, they just call it food. They don't call it Chinese food. But no, I'm just kidding. It's not like that at all, because do we need to just say this so that...
Yeah, I think we do, because, yeah. I mean, that's the whole reason why we're talking about this, Alan, is so that we can say this.
Okay, do you want to do it?
Yeah, Canadians call bacon, bacon. Oh, you know who actually... I don't know if I should say this, but you know who really messes up bacon? Like the appellation of different types of bacon is the British.
Oh.
Yeah, because like their bacon, like what we would call... Okay, maybe I should sorry, I'll back up a step. I'll disambiguate the Canadian bacon situation first, and then I'll move on to what the English refer to as bacon. So in Canada... we call bacon, which is a pork belly that has been cured and then sliced and usually smoked. That's called bacon. And it's also, that is also what is called bacon in the United States. In Canada, we call cured pork loin, we call that back bacon. In the States, they call it Canadian bacon, ostensibly because they think that that's what we think bacon is, which is not the case. Does that make sense? Is that, did I pretty much lay it out?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, this is just speculation. I wonder if the reason for the reason for Americans calling back bacon Canadian bacon is because they're there was a very important regional specialty in Ontario called pea meal bacon, which was back bacon crusted with crushed pea meal and then later cornmeal.
Right.
But if that were exported and called, if that were exported to the States and called bacon, the Americans would say, oh, that's way different than our bacon. Maybe we'll just call this Canadian bacon,
right,
even though it's...
I mean, I'm sure that's what happened, but it's still ridiculous.
Yeah. Yes.
Americans should just call back bacon, and then this wouldn't be a problem. And then the Brits call bacon streaky bacon.
They call bacon made from pork belly streaky bacon, and they call back bacon, right?
I think so.
Or do they just call back bacon bacon?
I don't think so, actually. I should have probably known this before I brought it up.
Before you got really smug about it.
Yeah, exactly.
There is like the Irvings that sells at the local farmers markets. Like they're run by an English family. A family from England. And they market their back bacon as back bacon.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they just do that for Canadians' sake or if that's how they would actually...
Right. I mean, probably it's because they're in Canada and they know that Canadians would know it as back bacon, but... So anyways, streaky bacon, and they call pieces of bacon rashers. So I don't know if that's what, I don't know what's,
oh, I like that. That.
Yeah. I kind of like that too. Got any other Canadian ingredients, Alan?
None as well known as the ones that we've listed. I think that there's some lesser known, like niche ones that you would see on, like the kinds of fancy menus that we're talking about at a big hotel, like flavors like cedar and juniper.
That's another,
these
kind
of,
that's
really
a good one.
Foresty,
you're right, foresty flavors, that's another big Canadian stereotypical kind of thing.
But to give you an idea, like this style of food where like you add one ingredient and all of a sudden the dish is Canadian, can I read you just a recipe title from Great Canadian Cuisine? Okay, here's one of the great Canadian dishes: grilled bocconcini cheese on fresh greens with papaya, sunflower seeds, and cedar dressing.
Oh my God. That's a Canadian dish?
Yeah, because it has cedar dressing.
And papaya.
I guess. And presumably Okanagan papaya.
Just like all good Canadian dishes, it has papaya in there.
Yeah.
I wonder where they got that papaya from. I mean, what is there any text around it, or is it just a recipe? I want to, I'm just super curious to know what about that the author thinks is Canadian. Is it because it uses ingredients from all over the world and we're a cultural mosaic, so it's like, you know, it's incorporating like a lot of cultural influences? Is that a part of their motivation for including it in a book about Canadian cooking? Or was it just, did it just happen to be a recipe that was on a hotel menu and they were like, oh, this has cedar dressing on it, so
it was on a menu at the Chateau Lake Louise. The only notes accompanying the recipe, it says using rosemary branches as skewers, and so this lets you know kind of what era this book is from, adds a dimension of flavor to any dish. Sherry vinegar is available at specialty food stores, and cedar jelly may be replaced with a black currant or fragrant wine jelly.
Those two things seem pretty different.
Kind of odd, but I mean, like, I don't think they mean to suggest that blackcurrant jelly tastes like cedar jelly, right. But I mean, like, if you really don't have cedar jelly and you need to add a jelly, maybe blackcurrant just kind of...
And if you still want your dish to be Canadian, then I guess you can use...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right.
Are you more or less annoyed by this, by the concept of Canadian cuisine after having discussed it for the last half hour?
the idea of a homogenous overarching Canadian cuisine is extremely irritating to me still.
So even more so probably.
Yeah. I would say so.
Yeah. I'm starting to be irritated too, actually, Alan.
Speaking of people who are irritated by Canadian cuisine, have you ever heard there is a recording of Colonel Sanders, like the real Colonel Sanders who started KFC? It was made by the CBC in Edmonton in 1957. And they ask him explicitly about Canadian food and what he thinks. And
okay.
You haven't heard it?
I don't know. It's ringing a bell. It's possible that you told me about this at one point previously or something, but
it's pretty amazing. He does not mince words, that man.
What does he say?
he says that basically, with the exception of French Canada, the food in Canada is just like the United States, only less flavorful, and I think he even says plum tasteless.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Like, he doesn't, I mean, whatever. I don't know how long he spent in Canada or in Western Canada, but yeah, in his, and I don't know. I think he's probably a man who understands food.
Definitely. He's probably a man who's thought about it quite a bit.
Yeah. In whatever amount of time he spent here, he didn't really see any important distinction in the terms of like ingredients and dishes and how people eat on a daily basis between, especially in the West, he said, Western Canada and the United States.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's some truth to that. I don't know. I'm agreeing with a colonel from the South. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. But I definitely think that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, a lot of the food that is to be had in Canada is like heavily imported from American culture.
Yes.
And probably a lot of it originates from the States. I don't know for sure. Hamburger? That come from the States, or is that from Hamburg, Alan? You know. You know everything about Germany.
About Germany? I think like it kind of speaks to, we've talked about this before, but like a lot of this conversation is kind of like happening within foodie circles. Mm-hmm. And when you take a step back and look at like for instance, at the beginning, when you were talking about like Canadian cuisine, like started with indigenous food and then like all these other elements are slowly added. But like at the end of the, again, that sounds great, but the way that most people eat in this country most of the time has nothing to do with like, you know, the wild foods we're talking about and like the real cultural traditions. Like it's more like, well, we live in North America. And like we live, and especially us in the West, like we live in like my ancestors didn't come to this part of the world until well after the Industrial Revolution and like all these kind of convenience products existed. And we might be, sorry, do you know what I mean? Like we might be a little bit, not out of touch, but like, we're looking at it within the world of like within, like it's conversations that are happening within food communities, like or communities that are like really into food.
I mean, definitely. I think that that's true of the conversation that we're having, but I also think that like there's, I don't know how to best put this, but like, okay. Yeah. So there's like a pervasive sort of food culture around the things that you're talking about, like the convenience foods and all the foods that are like, sort of like, I would say like, you know, American, like that are a big part of like American and Canadian culture. I'm not going to say North American because I feel like Mexico has a very different food culture than either the States or Canada. Not that it isn't influenced by the States or whatever, but definitely it has its own distinctive like food culture and plenty of regionality and all of those things. But I think that like the things that I was referring to earlier about the like buildup over time of like the food that we eat and have access to in Canada, it's not just like the conversation really is only happening in like, you know, maybe amongst foodies or foodie culture or something like that. But there's like a pervasive sort of aspect of how that all of that food has grown over time that really, I think, does make Canada, I don't want to say unique necessarily, because there are certainly cities in the States where this is also the case. I find like no matter what Canadian city you go to, this isn't necessarily true of small towns, and small towns I think like probably have more, are more about regionality or like maybe specific products that are, you know, that are available around, you know, like either in the prairies or in central Canada or in Quebec or in the Maritimes or in BC, or in the Northern Territories. But then, there's also, you know, like in every Canadian city that you go to, there are great restaurants in just about every Canadian city from cultures from all around the world. You know, like, and I mean, I haven't been everywhere, but I think, you know, in most cities in Canada, you can find pretty authentic representations of food from just about all over the world. And that's also true of a lot of American cities, like, you know, LA has, you know, tons of that, and New York obviously has tons of that, and plenty of other American cities, I'm sure, have like the same sort of thing. But like just as an example, I eat a ton of Vietnamese food. I love Vietnamese food. I've never been to Vietnam, but you know, like the food that's available in Canada is like, I'm just a huge fan of it. And when I moved to Denmark, there's just not a Vietnamese restaurant. Like, it just doesn't, like, I think there's one in Copenhagen, and yeah, like one or two. I don't know. And maybe that's changed a little bit more recently, but I think that that's sort of like, I think that that's not uncommon in Europe for there to not be sort of like representations of food from all over the world, or like they're far fewer, like, and farther between.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And so like that to me is something that's sort of like, isn't like a foodie thing, but is just sort of pervasive in the way that Canadians eat. Like, you know, like it's not Chinese food, it's Canadian Chinese food, but you know, it's totally on the menu. You know, for most Canadians, it's not like, you know, it's not like a weird thing that you know, people only eat sometimes. Like everyone's aware of it, and it's like, you know, full, you know, like everyone's aware of it in the popular sense, you know, whereas, in most places in Europe, that's just not really how things are. Like, it's, you know, their cuisine is like more insular, and for fairly obvious reasons, like they have way less recent immigration. And and so you know, there just hasn't been the opportunity for other cultures' food culture to flourish within Europe. And, you know, really, they're like, I feel like it's sorely missing over there. And I think it's kind of interesting too, because I feel like a lot of chefs, like high-end chefs, get exposed to cuisines that, like, you know, maybe I've been eating like multiple examples of since I was a teenager. And, like, you know, suddenly they're exposed to it because they travel somewhere, or a chef comes to work in their restaurant from another place in the world, and they get exposed to something that really they haven't had much exposure to before. And it just sort of like blows their wig back. And then they suddenly have to go and do a pop-up restaurant in Japan or something, you know, like that kind of thing seems to happen quite a bit. And I think it's because, you know, like it's just like because of more recent exposure, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. That was definitely my experience in Europe too. Like, for the first, the first few weeks or the first month, like only eating like traditional food from, say, Austria or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then like needing a bit of a break or something different. And then like looking, like seeking out something like a Thai restaurant. And it's like, there's like, it felt like there was one Thai restaurant in the entire country.
Yeah.
And like one Mexican restaurant in the entire country, which makes sense. It makes sense that there's obviously more like Mexican and Salvadoran, like in Edmonton than in Austria.
Right. But what about Ethiopian? But, like, there's tons of Ethiopian in Edmonton, but like, there's not an Ethiopian restaurant. There might be an Ethiopian restaurant in some European cities, but I'll bet that there are quite a few that have zero, you know.
Right. And actually, generally, to the, like, I found that the quality when we did go to like those ethnic restaurants or whatever they're supposed to be called, like, the quality was not the same as it is here.
Right.
I almost wondered, like, if it's like, if that part of their food scene is kind of where ours was 50 or 70 years ago, where like it's so different to so much of the population that it really needs to be like clawed back and presented in a different and less authentic way to make it more approachable to them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely feel like that was the case with the Vietnamese restaurant that I ate in Copenhagen. Like, it was pretty highly westernized compared to a lot of the Vietnamese food that I've eaten like in Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver.
Right. Yeah.
It was definitely made to be more accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that was after like 3 or 4 months of being in Copenhagen, where I was like feeling a little bit homesick, and I was like, oh,
right,
I wonder if I could get pho here. And then I started researching, and I think it took me like a week to actually find out that there was a Vietnamese restaurant. And then it was in some backwater neighborhood that I had to ride my bicycle like 2 hours to get to. But yeah, so like I think that that's something about, you know, Canadian food culture that, you know, is somewhat defining of what I would say Canadian cuisine sort of is, in terms of exposing Canadians to different types of cuisine. You know, it's pretty unique compared to what you would find in a lot of parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. Like, 'cause it's so often like we tell our young culinarians to look to Europe,
right,
like for the traditions, the recipes, the techniques, the whatever. But like, yeah, that's something that the New World does really well, is like, that idea of the mosaic, like, for Canada specifically, like, our country only survives and grows because of immigration, right? So like, it's, so it's cool to have that kind of injection of new stuff all the time.
The best Indian food I ever had though was in London.
Have you been to India?
No, I have not been to India. But definitely there, because of colonialism, I guess there's like a huge number of, there's a, you know, large Indian population in England and a huge number of Indian restaurants. And their national dish is chicken tikka masala. So,
yeah. Yeah. Is that voted by, is it like, how does something become the national dish?
I don't know too much about their political system. Let me think.
So no, I think it is a
honestly though, I do I think it's a parliamentary mandate and that, you know, that it had to be, yeah, it had to have been approved by parliament.
Oh yeah. Cool.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I heard that somewhere. Okay, Alan, I'm going to run down. Do you got anything else?
No.
Okay. I'm going to run down the list of stereotypical Canadian dishes, and you tell me Canada, yes or no.
Canada, yes or no?
Or something. I don't know.
Okay.
You tell me if it's Canadian or not.
Okay.
Poutine.
Yes.
Would you call it Canadian?
Yeah, okay. So to me, poutine began as a regional dish. And even like when I was growing up, and we're talking about the 80s and 90s, I was aware of it. It was not something that was on every corner. And just because a place was serving French fries, hey, I come from a place that actually has a very strong French fry culture. I grew up in Brightsgrove, Ontario, and in Sarnia, there's like chip trucks that kind of park under the Blue Water Bridge. And that's the thing you do on the weekend. You go into the town, you go to the chip truck, you get a box of fries and you walk around.
There's more than one chip truck.
Oh yeah.
Cool.
And now I feel like if there was such a truck, like there would automatically be like a make it a poutine $5 add-on kind of thing. But like we were aware of poutine, but it was not, it was something from Quebec.
Right.
But in the last, maybe 15 years ago, there was this kind of like poutine mania that went across the entire country through, like there was chains like La Poutine and stuff like that. And it started becoming like, it showed up on almost anywhere French fries were, like, you know, like New York fries, what you could go and you could make it a poutine. So I do think now it is, I guess, I mean, it's kind of a fad, but like those chains are still around. So sorry, this was supposed to be a yes or no rapid fire thing. So.
I don't know, whatever. But do you think, so like,
do you know what I mean?
I know exactly
what you mean. Did
you grow up eating
poutine? Okay.
But I also wonder, like, I think that like sort of like poutine, like pervasiveness or like the sort of revolution in poutine, like, you know, becoming something that like moved across the country, like you said. I don't know. I think that might have something to do with it showing up in American pop culture as a Canadian dish or something.
Really?
Yeah.
This is getting so meta.
I know. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
I can't put my finger on where, but I know that, you know, it started to be like talked about in as like a joke, as like what people ate in Canada, like either in the context that, you know, like it's got a weird name and nobody knew what it was or something, or like, I think,
right.
I don't know. I remember
it was like How I Met Your Mother or something.
Or like, I think I remember
there was a lot of
like
Canadian,
mentions of it in South Park, because South Park really loved to sort of like, use Canadians and Canadian culture as like the butt of a kind of weird, long-running joke that they had. So maybe South Park, maybe something else. I can't really think of what it might have been, like maybe in some movies or something, but I think it sort of like got picked up as like a joke about, you know, the only thing that Canadians eat at some point, and then it just, and then that like got reflected back into Canada, and then everyone started, well, and then obviously it's delicious, so then everyone started just eating it.
But what does that say about the national psyche? That's so pathetic. Like, Americans think we eat this, so we better if we eat it. If we eat it, we'll have an identity.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what happened. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Wow.
I don't know. I wish I had some proof.
Oh, that's so pathetic.
I really have no idea. But I don't know, something. That's just like a feeling that I have, is that that's sort of part of what happened. So I guess soon we'll all be living in igloos. Okay, I'm going to keep going down the list, Alan. Butter tarts.
Okay. No, regional.
Okay. Regional from where?
Ontario.
We might have to fight.
Did your mom make butter tarts when you were little?
Yeah.
Is your mom from Ontario?
Nope. She's from Red Deer, so...
You know what? So I had never even heard of butter tarts until a few years ago on July 1st. Thomas Keller posted a picture of butter tarts at the French Laundry and said Happy Canada Day.
Huh.
And I was like, what are those? Aren't those Portuguese? I had never heard of them.
You'd never heard of butter tarts?
No.
Fascinating. Yet you're claiming that it's it's a regional Ontario dish.
I think, isn't it? I think it's from the east.
I'm sure you're right. I mean, it's basically like sugar pie, so that really makes sense.
Yeah.
Lobster roll.
Regional.
Obviously.
Like, there's no way. Yeah, like it's from the Maritimes. Like, mm-hmm. It's.
I'm not even gonna say that.
Am I ruining the game?
No.
Am I ruining?
You're doing great, Alan. There's a bunch of dishes that are called Montreal something. So might as well just skip those.
Because I'm just going to blurt regional. Well, actually, I think that something similar happened with Montreal smoked meat as poutine, where it's like. Mm-hmm.
Suddenly now it's Canadian food when, you know, really it just used to be available in a few delis in Montreal.
Yeah. Yeah. And, just as tangent for your own knowledge, there's a really great article that I cannot remember the name or the publication or the author, but that talks about how Montreal smoked meat is like, it's not an independent tradition from New York pastrami. It's like some genius went to New York, saw pastrami, said, hey, there's a big kosher and Jewish population in Montreal. We should make something like this in Montreal.
Yeah.
Like there's a historical line from one to the other. It's not two independent traditions, if that makes sense. Like they're different preparations and now have their own thing, but like there's documented, there's a paper trail that shows that like they saw it in New York and they brought it to Montreal.
That's cool that there's a paper trail. That's definitely what I would have assumed though also.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Well, I would have thought if the origin of pastrami in New York is like Eastern Europeans, Jewish Eastern Europeans bringing it over from Europe.
Yeah, which it most certainly is, right?
Montreal had the same, like a similar kind of wave of immigration from the same area.
Yeah, yeah.
So it could have just been like they both draw their ancestry to the old world, but actually the Montreal smoked meat draws its ancestry from New York.
I wonder if the same can be said for the bagels.
Mm, that's a good question.
Yeah. Or whether the bagels came over from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're fairly different in style, the Montreal bagels and the New York bagels.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving right along, pea meal bacon.
It's a regional specialty from along the St. Lawrence, places like Toronto. Yeah.
Okay. What about this one? Split pea soup.
That's a good one. I know it's eaten all over, and I think that it probably has become something of a national dish. And even though it's eaten in the Maritimes and Ontario especially, there's a story to split pea soup that it's very closely related to Quebec. And actually, Emmanuel Thériault told me that in Quebec, pisou was like a derogatory word for a Quebecer that an Anglophone would use.
Huh.
Like, so everybody eats it, but like in this context, it's like associated with like the French speaking lower classes.
Harsh.
Yeah.
you hate to hear it, Alan.
Yeah.
Okay. Maple toffee, or yeah, maple toffee.
if you think maple syrup is a Canadian ingredient, then yeah.
Okay.
We could say that's a...
Okay. Nanaimo bars.
I think that one I would say is Canadian now. Like, obviously it has a specific origin, but like it's been kind of adopted and naturalized across the entire country.
Yeah. Like, you definitely find that in church basements in BC, Alberta, Manitoba.
Yes.
Ontario.
You missed one.
Quebec. I wonder yeah. if you find it in church basements in Quebec.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. But that's something. Yeah, like I grew up with them for sure in Ontario.
Okay. Ketchup chips.
Yeah.
Canadian.
Yeah.
All dress chips. Same situation, yeah. Right? Like pure Canadian.
Yeah.
Caesar's, the drink.
That's another one. Like, yeah, it has a specific origin in Calgary, but like it's on menus in fancy places in Montreal and all over the place. So sure. Canadian.
And yeah, they don't know what Caesars are in the States, right? They have Bloody Marys and that's that.
Yeah, they have Bloody Marys, but like if there's no clam juice in your cocktail, why are you even drinking?
What are we even doing? Do they have you had very many Bloody Marys in the States, Alan? Do you know anything about it?
Have I had many Bloody Marys in the States? No.
Oh, do you know if they put like meals, if they attach meals to their drinks? When you order a Bloody Mary in the States, does it sometimes come with like two sliders and a deep fried pickle and four asparagus spears and an olive and a fork?
It sounds American, yeah.
You would think, right? But that, I don't know. Yeah. I wonder. I feel like it might be like a purely Canadian BS thing. That's most of the ones I got. Tortiere. I mean, we kind of already talked about it.
Yeah, my only comment on that would be, like, we said that it was a regional dish, but I do think that, like, there's a lot of Francophones in Alberta who, like, maybe their ancestry ultimately does come from Quebec, but, like, they eat what I would call Quebecois food, but they're obviously Albertan. Sorry, do you know what I mean? So like, it's not so much of a regional thing. It's like a cultural thing. And like the like French Canadian culture
right,
is all over the place.
Yeah. Well, or pockets of it are. I mean, like it's pretty rare to encounter it in Alberta, I feel like, but it definitely exists. I was exposed to it quite a bit when I was a kid because I was in French immersion in school, but
right.
But it's like, you know, I feel like in most Albertans' daily life, they probably don't run into it very much.
Yeah. Like if you just say most, that's probably correct. But there are there's French speaking communities and towns like Legal or like, I don't know, there's, this is maybe more, I don't know if this is like a tourism thing or what, but you can go to like Bonnie Doon and the east end of White Avenue and like the stop signs are in French. like around the Faculté Saint-Jean and
totally.
Stuff.
But sort of like a little pocket of around the Faculté Saint-Jean there's like a little pocket of French Canadian, sort of French Canada town or something.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
they have a great winter festival down there.
Canot Volant. Or the flying canoe, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's fun.
Hmm. Okay. What about bannock?
It's something... So this is my understanding of... Well, I don't know. Yeah, like it's...
Do you think... Okay, so, I mean, I think when I hear bannock, it definitely rings, you know, like it rings bells of like Canadian indigenous food for me. I think mm-hmm. I think its origin is Métis. Mm-hmm. Not 100% sure. But I wonder if you said bannock to an American, what would they think? Would they have never heard of it? Would they have heard of it and think of it as Canadian food, or would they have heard of it and think of it as like American or Native American food?
Mm-hmm. I have no idea. This is one thing I've been wanting to look up. So like I have a Scottish cookbook and a kind of like a historic historical cookbook. Like it was published, I think in the, I don't know. Scrap that. I don't know when it was published.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. This is interesting to me, Alan, because ostensibly my heritage is Scottish, so.
Right, yeah. What do you mean ostensibly?
Well, I guess it really is. I don't know. I just.
You mean you won't know until you do a 21 and what are those called? Those
23 and me?
DNA
yeah,
tests?
Yeah, exactly.
23 and me, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like definitely part Scottish and probably part Neanderthal from what I understand.
So in the Scottish cookbook, it uses the word bannock and it uses the word scone. And the difference between bannock and scone in this book is that a scone, I hope I'm not mixing this up. A scone is something where you bake a large loaf or round of it, and then you cut pieces from it. Whereas a bannock is something that you bake in an individual size.
Huh.
I hope I didn't get those backwards. I don't know anything about the history, and I was just speculating, but I was wondering, like, because there was a lot of Scottish like culture and influence in some of the Métis communities, like especially Manitoba.
Right.
Like if that was at least where the word came from or what.
So is the book is from Scotland or it's like.
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. That kind of rings a bell, actually. I did a bunch of research on bannock recipes at one point.
Oh, really?
And I think I remember coming across that the terminology is actually European or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess bannock's kind of similar. In some of its iterations, bannock is kind of similar to a scone.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of iterations of bannock, though.
Yeah.
It's like tons. Whether it's like baked or fried, and then what you use for leaveners, and yeah, is like, and the hydration varies like all over the place, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. But usually, like,
it's pretty interesting.
Usually, just like flour, water, lard, and baking powder or something like that, right?
Yeah, kind of chemical like leavener, a quick usually, bread. And then yeah. But yeah, then sometimes yeah, it's like. Baked individually, sometimes it's baked in a large like loaf or sheet, and then a lot of the time it's also fried, and then you know the people that I've like gotten bannock recipes from, they're always like 100% certain that theirs is the true bannock,
right? Yep.
There was something else that I was going to say about it too. Oh, yes, I do remember. Like I was mentioning, when I was young, I was in French immersion in elementary school and part of junior high. And so in elementary school, we did quite a bit of sort of like recreation of French Canadian cultural things. And French Canadian holidays and things like that. And because a lot of the teachers were French Canadian, and so you know they wanted to have those traditions or show those traditions to us, and so we celebrated a lot of French Canadian traditions, and then additionally we also like learned a lot about Métis culture and celebrated some traditional Métis celebrations and things like that. And there was my first ever exposure to bannock was that I can't remember what grade I was in, like grade three or grade four or something. We like made bannock, a large batch of dough, and then went and we all went and found sticks and then put bannock on a stick and roasted it over a fire.
Right. Yeah.
Which trying to get a bunch of grade threers to cook bannock over a fire and have it be edible is like, you know, a completely impossible task. Yeah, it's a fool's errand. But I never forgot about it. And I was like, whoa, like, yeah, it's always sort of been in the back of my mind. And for a long time, whenever anyone would say bannock, that's what I thought. It's like bread that you bake on a stick.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how pervasive that is, like cooking bannock over a fire on a stick. Like, I wonder how popular a thing to do that is, like in reality, or whether it was just like special occasion thing that we did, or the sort of like a celebratory traditional thing or something that nobody really does or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
We also made maple taffy when I was in elementary school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you do that too?
Where my father's family is from is a sugar bush kind of country. So I've been to the sugar shacks and had the the maple taffy, and it's something, especially now, like I made it with Cora this spring with some of the last snow that was left in the year, because she's in French immersion, so she's doing a lot of the same stuff that you're talking about, like some of the Métis culture and some of the Québécois stuff. And so yeah, we made tire de neige, and yeah, I like it.
Cool. Yeah. Well, did we solve anything, Alan?
Do we ever?
Of course. We always find a definite answer to the question that we pose at the beginning of the podcast. What question was that? It was, why is Alan irritated by the idea of Canadian cuisine?
Yeah, the question of my irritation, like, it's because people are either not talking about the same thing or not talking about cuisine, or most importantly, I think I wouldn't have thought that this was the single biggest one, but after this conversation, I think it's that there are certainly Canadian cuisines. There is no homogenous, overarching Canadian cuisine that spreads from sea to sea to sea. And it's annoying to when people try and construct that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I read a really dumb quote on Wikipedia while I was like doing a little bit of research before this. I think it's from
while I was just talking. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. While I was bored.
This guy, shut up. Are you on your phone right now?
Obviously joking, Alan. It's from Joe Clark, I think. Someone asked him if there's Canadian cuisine, and he said that Canada has a cuisine of cuisines.
Ooh. Joe Clark.
There's one for you, Alan.
Wow. That's good.
Yeah, it's not bad.
That's really good. He was our greatest prime minister. Just kidding.
Is that true?
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.